Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and our good friend Emily Bazelon joins us now. She's a senior editor and Supreme Court watcher at Slate and a panelist on their Political Gabfest that we air weekends here on WNYC. And today she's with us mostly to talk about her new book, Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. And we'll also talk a little bit about the Supreme Court, that eye-popping case that they decided to accept yesterday. Emily, hi. We've spoken on the phone, I think, a zillion and 25 times, and here you are in studio for the first time. It's great to see your smiling face.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And this is your first book, and its topic is something that you've written about a good deal over the years. We've talked about it before. How did you get interested in bullying, of all things?
A few years ago, I started reading a lot of stories in the news, particularly about cyberbullying. And they treated this as a new, really scary phenomenon and also as potentially epidemic. So I was interested partly as a parent. I have kids who are now 10 and 13, and I was thinking, okay, well, how has the internet really changed how kids grow up? And is it really true that cyberbullying has raised the rates of bullying in a very alarming way?
And so you write that in order to confront the culture of bullying, it's important to first know what bullying is, and perhaps just importantly, what it isn't. Do you think people overdefine bullying?
I think they do. The definition of bullying I find really useful is physical or verbal abuse that repeats over time and that involves a power imbalance. So you can see in that definition, we're not talking about kids having one fight one time, and we're not talking about mutual conflict, what kids often call drama. This is a particular form of harmful aggression.
And with regards to what we may call general acts of meanness, they don't necessarily constitute the definition of bullying, as you caution adults from acting too rashly?
Exactly. You know, you want to make sure when you're using this label of bully, which is a pretty stigmatizing thing to say about a kid, that you're really defining it properly and that you're not missing some more kind of mutual fighting that's going on underneath.
So these conflicts, you write, can actually serve an important purpose in a child's development. You want to go there?
Yeah, so I'm not talking about bullying, which really is something that we should address and try and reduce, but you're never going to have a world in which kids are nice to each other all the time, and they need to learn how to solve their own problems. So we need to apply the label sparingly so that we address what the real harm is, but then also leave kids some room to grow in managing their own conflict.
But you also say that bullying is far from being an epidemic, as the media might make it out to be recently, and that it's not as big of a problem in most kids' lives as adults believe it to be. So have you written a book to almost not excuse bullying, but tell everybody to calm down?
I want people to be worried about the right things, okay? So it's true that bullying's not epidemic, and the rates haven't really changed over the last 25 years. And when you think about how much kids used to get beaten up physically, you can see that we're not talking about some new alarming phenomenon. On the other hand, the internet does make kids feel like bullying is 24/7 and they can't escape it. And this really is a problem worth paying attention to because it comes with some pretty significant psychological harms. It's associated with low school performance. And even into adulthood, it can have lasting consequences.
Listeners, we have time for a phone call or two for Emily Bazelon. If you have a bullying story that you would really like her to address, or a bullying policy question for that matter, like on how well you think your school is handling it or not, 212-433-WNYC 433-9692. Her new book, Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. And you get into strategies that schools across the country are implementing to combat bullying. And there are some you like and there are some you don't like. So, for example, you're actually against the idea of suspending students for bullying as much as it gets done. Why is that?
Suspension is just not a punishment that has a big deterrent effect. We don't find the kids who are suspended cut out the behavior that led to the suspension. And it also takes kids out of school when maybe what they really need is to be learning more. It takes the kids who tend to be having problems and sticks them at home where they're not in the classroom getting the, you know, intellectual endeavor they need there.
What's a better way?
A better way is, and this is hard and takes some work, but it involves really changing the school culture. So what you want is a school in which kids are not becoming more popular by being mean, because that's one of the reasons kids bully, is they can see that it adds to their social status. On the other hand, most kids, if you ask them, they don't like bullying. They disapprove it. And so if they feel like they're in an environment where standing up for other kids in large ways and sometimes just in small ways by expressing sympathy, when that is valued, then you kind of isolate the bullies and you reduce the problematic behavior.
You're also a legal. Are you a lawyer, by the way?
I am, although you would not want to hire me because I passed the bar several years ago, but I've never practiced.
You're right. I don't want to hire you. But that's how you became a Supreme Court watcher. And we'll talk about the court in a minute. But with respect to bullying, it has moved beyond the school hallway and the gym locker onto the internet and into the courts. So what have the courts had to say when schools intervene in cyberbullying or in-person bullying cases?
Courts have a standard right now. It actually comes from the Supreme Court. And it's that schools can discipline kids for speech if it causes a big disruption in the school. And so now there's this struggle. Okay, well, how do you apply that standard if the misconduct takes place on Facebook or through text messages? It's not actually happening in the school at all. And that's this big question. And so far, it's really unsettled. We've had some courts that have said, you know what, it's the same thing. If the schools can show that even if conflict didn't happen in the school, it could have from something that originated online, they can still discipline kids. And other courts have said, you know what, this is too far into the zone of students' free speech rights. And we can't have schools reaching beyond the property of the school into the internet to discipline kids.
Rebecca in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Emily Bazelon. Hello.
Hi there. My son, who's just turned 15, is freshman in high school, and he's had this incident going on probably for a good 2-3 months now of this girl bullying my son. And I said, what does she say? She said, well, she just talks loud enough so I can overhear her, so I know that she's talking about me. I'm like, what does she talk about? And he says, well, my hair, my clothes, how stupid she thinks I am, and just continually just verbally abusing him. And he finally had it, and I got a call from his principal last Friday, and he had come around the corner of the school, and my son was letting this girl have it verbally. He said, just knock it off. And he called him in. He was the one that was getting in trouble. And I said, I know it's a case of bullying. This has been going on, but he wouldn't reach out to anybody, teachers or anybody in the school, because they didn't feel like it was their problem or they could take care of it.
Rebecca, thank you for that. And one, does this fit your definition of bullying, what that girl was doing? And two, how do you think the school handled it based on what you know?
That does sound like bullying. And it sounds like the problem here, and this happens a lot, is that this victim got really frustrated, had all this pent-up distress about what was happening. But because he hadn't felt safe going to the school and asking for help, they didn't really understand the underlying dynamic. And then he kind of, in the moment, lashed out and got in trouble for it. And that's really not a good outcome.
So what could the school have set up, in theory, as an outlet for him to go to somebody before it reached that point?
Some schools have had good experience with reporting bullying through what they call logs, where they encourage kids to come in, and sometimes you can do it anonymously, and just write down what someone is saying and say who it is. And then, even if you're not willing to come forward yourself, you can see if there's one kid who's causing trouble in a pattern or for a bunch of other kids. And then it's time for the guidance counselors and the administrators to step in and try and help that kid cut it out.
Leslie in Newark, you're on WNYC with Emily Bazelon. Hello. Oh, it would help if I actually pressed the button to put Leslie on the air. Hi, Leslie. Now I think we have you. I apologize.
Hi, good morning. I'm an administrator at a charter school here in Newark. And last year, the state legislature passed ruling about anti-bullying in schools, this Harassment, Intimidation, and Anti-Bullying Act. And as a result, there's a tremendous amount of responsibility placed on the schools for managing incidents that happen far outside the boundaries of the school, including, you know, in home areas and communities, on the weekends, of course, in the internet. And the state's definition of bullying is very broad. So it is a one-time incident. It does include, a single incident, regardless of, it's not required to be ongoing.
So what position does that put the school in?
Well, it's very challenging. I mean, again, these are kids, and kids often make poor choices and say bad things.
Right.
And often if you follow up with them immediately, you can, nip something in the bud, and it's not an incident, and it's not disruptive. However, if we have to follow a very prescriptive disciplinary action with every single incident, it actually distracts from learning.
I'm really glad you raised this, because it is such a New Jersey issue in our area's consciousness ever since the Tyler Clementi incident at Rutgers, and I think that's why the legislature passed this law.
I think you're right, and I understand responding to that incident, but I'm not a big fan of New Jersey's law for exactly the reasons that your caller just brought up. It's very broad and unrealistic for schools, often makes them feel they're kind of buried in paperwork. And one thing I really think we need to have a bigger conversation about is we are asking schools to take on a big burden here and really shoulder the responsibility of raising our kids and instilling values and dealing with misbehavior in a way that wasn't true a generation ago. And I don't think it's clear that schools have the resources to do that, because we haven't really thought through what we're demanding.
Emily Bazelon from Slate, her new book, Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. And for our last 3 minutes or so, let me ask you to put on your Supreme Court Watchers hat and give us your take on the case they accepted yesterday that could loosen campaign finance laws even more than Citizens United, which our listeners are hearing that. What? You can't loosen them any more than Citizens United. But you can, right?
You can. We still have contribution limits for individual donations. And this case is about aggregating those donations together. So we're not yet to the point of the lawsuit challenging having, I think it's a 25 or 2600 limit on one candidate. This is about lots of different candidates, how much total money. But the idea of challenging individual contribution limits, that would be a real change. And the difference, Citizens United, as much as it has changed the landscape, you still have to give to a super PAC or some nonprofit that is not directly the candidate. This would mean you could potentially give unlimited amounts of money directly to political candidates.
And the basic premise, and tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is in the court's seminal campaign finance ruling, Buckley versus Vallejo in 1976, the court said campaign spending cannot be limited because spending equals speech, but donations can be limited to reduce the chance for corruption. Does this revisit that basic premise?
It absolutely does. And in Citizens United, the court expressed a lot of skepticism that corruption and quid pro quo for campaign donations is still a problem, even though there's a lot of evidence that it is. But it does make you wonder if this new case is about overturning the part of Buckley that it imposes some limit.
So for people, even Justice Ginsburg, I think, who predicted that they would roll back their own Citizens United decision in not the too distant future, this looks like au contraire. They think the problem in society might still be that the rules on wealthy donors are still too tight.
It's possible. Maybe Justice Ginsburg will be in the majority this time, and they will use this case to roll back the changes in Citizens United. But the way it's set up makes you think that it may very well go in the opposite direction.
And my expectations for the court are low, but could they use this as an opportunity to look at corruption and the legal corruption that you were implying a minute ago, the way campaign donations, resulted in a kind of a winner-take-all politics where the wealthiest donors control the lion's share of policy?
They absolutely could, because there's a lot of evidence that that is happening. And, we had this interesting moment last year where the Montana Supreme Court, trying to uphold contribution limits and campaign finance reform in Montana, amassed all this evidence about a century's worth of corruption, which the Supreme Court didn't seem interested, our Supreme Court, then. But certainly Montana's not alone in this.
And another Supreme Court thing, real quick, of interest to us both as journalists and citizens. Justice Sotomayor seems to have changed her position recently on cameras at the Supreme Court. According to the American Bar Association Journal, she had previously said she had positive experiences with cameras in her appeals court, but now worries that televising Supreme Court proceedings could mislead the public. Are you surprised about that?
I am, and I'm really disappointed. The justices seem to be open to the idea of cameras in the courtroom until they get on the bench, and then suddenly – they don't want them there. And what Sotomayor said was she didn't think that most people would really understand what happened at oral arguments, which seems awfully condescending. And I just, you know, I think that it would enhance the debate to hear more and that the justices shouldn't be afraid of that.
And to tie it all together this way, if Justice Scalia tried to bully anyone up there, the world would be able to see it and you could send them to the principal's office.
Exactly.
Oh, that doesn't work. No, you wrote that that doesn't work. Emily Bazelon from Slate, Supreme Court watcher and the author now of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, President Obama's car czar, Stephen Ratner, our next guest. Stay tuned.